Hi guys, just before you listen to this week's episode of Worst Foot Forward with Naomi Paxton, all about the world's worst speech, a quick hello from me, Barry, and a big congratulations on my behalf and on behalf of many of you as well, because you might have seen on Twitter that my illustrious co-host Ben has had a baby, or rather his wife has had a baby. Ben made a small contribution about 9 months ago. But yes, Ben and his wife Silvana welcomed a little baby girl into the world last weekend, and so Ben is taking a well-deserved break from editing these for the next few weeks. I wanted to say congratulations to them. Many of you have already been saying so on Twitter and in emails and things like that, so thank you for that. It's a very odd thing to be involved in a podcast where we sort of tend to note just how bad things are in the world, and yet here we are introducing another human into it. So welcome Lily, and well done Ben and Silv. In other happy news, thank you to, there's a whole bunch of you who've been sending us lovely emails over the last week or two. So I just wanted to say little shout outs. Some of you may have seen us, we retweeted a picture of a map. One of our lovely followers, Mats Tusenfoot from Sweden, who is one of our Patreon donors, he sent us a picture after our World's Worst Map episode of a map of the world that he had cut up and then sewn back together again for a project. we retweeted the picture on Twitter, so if you haven't seen it already, do look it up. It is brilliant, and you can find us on Twitter, of course, on @worstfoot. I'm on @basmaxday, and Ben is on @benvandeveld. What else? We had a couple of lovely reviews coming through on Podblast. Thank you for those people who are writing lovely reviews and saying nice things about us. And thank you to another long-term listener, Tikva. She forwarded a quote from Small Gods, Terry Pratchett's Small Gods, which she thought we'd like, and I liked it so much I thought we'd share it with you as well. Sometimes the crime follows the punishment, which only serves to prove the foresight of the great God. That's what my grandmother used to say, said Brother automatically. Indeed, I would like to know more about this formidable lady. She used to give me a thrashing every morning because I would certainly do something that deserved it during the day, said Brother. A most complete understanding of the nature of mankind. So yes, if we take one thing from this intro, make sure to give yourselves a good thrashing every morning. Careful now. And thank you to the recent Patreoner, Jenny D'Souza as well, who sent us an email talking about patents and suggesting we look, if we do an episode about patents, which we most certainly should do, suggesting we look at underwear, and particularly anti-masturbation pants. Anti-masturbation pants, anti-wedgie underpants, a fly with a ruler attached. These are the sort of emails which land in the Worst Foot Forward inbox. So I thought you'd all like a little look behind the curtain there. If you want to send us an email, do get in touch on worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com. And you can find all of our past episodes on worstfootforwardpodcast.com. That's enough. Settle down and enjoy this week's episode, which is a really fun one, all about the world's worst speech.
Hello, mighty humans, and welcome one and all to another episode of Worst Foot Forward, the podcast where each week we uncover the best of the worst. Many people say that public speaking is their greatest fear in the world. The classic maxim is that at a funeral, many people would rather be the ones in the casket than the person giving the eulogy, which is why we here at Worst Foot Forward have been practicing our private speaking instead, and are happy to offer our services as the finest private speakers in the world. Want someone to stand in a broom cupboard in the basement of a disused car park giving their finest thoughts on air raid shelters of the 1940s? We're your guys. Need a quick sonnet blasted out in the middle of the Atacama Desert? Right here for you. Want to book someone to do the after-dinner piece at the Kazakhstani Alan Titchmarsh Appreciation Society? Got it covered, lads. And with me is the austere wood-carved lectern to my fire and brimstone sermon, Barry McStay.
Oh, yeah, no, I think Charlie Dimmock is bigger in Astana than Titchmarsh is. We both have to give speeches in our time. You gave a speech at my wedding, in fact.
I did well. I mean, essentially, giving a speech is just a grander version of what I do for a living.
Yeah, I think
the difference between a speech and stand-up is that if someone interrupts you during an after-dinner speech, you're not allowed to call them a cunt and suggest that the sexual proclivities of their mother are something that we need to discuss in front of a wider audience.
Yeah, and I wish you hadn't shouted at my uncle that way.
Yeah. It was like, because yours is the, I think of all the weddings I've been to, yours is the only one where it was a double header best man speech because there were two best men.
Yes.
I think yours is the only gay wedding I've been to. And obviously there's gay weddings give a whole, what's the word I'm looking for? Sort of logistical problem when it comes to the traditional liturgy. You're just kind of like, God, you mean we're going to have to sit through two of everything? No, thanks.
No, we had a 5-minute time limit on every speech apart from the best man speech.
Yeah, oh, mate, we went on. And like, basically, Joe, your husband's best man, was very much the heart and soul and the deeply emotive remembrances of friendship.
You mean he cried three times? He cried three times.
I know. And I was wacky sidekick.
Yeah. That's very much the role that you're playing to me now as well. Let's introduce our third wheel then. Our guest this week, the wacky sidecar, if you like. Our guest this week is a performer, writer and broadcaster. But who isn't? She's currently employed as Knowledge Exchange Fellow at the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama in London, as well as an Associate Fellow at the School of Advanced Study at University of London. And Ben, that is more fellowship than a J.R.R. Tolkien novel right there. Having trained as a performer and worked as a professional actor, she completed a PhD on the work of the Actresses Franchise League and the contribution of theatre professionals to the suffrage campaign. Indeed, she also edited the Methuen Drama Book of Suffrage Plays in 2013 and again a couple of years later, presumably after 150 years of men doing it. Among the many strings to her bow, she curates exhibitions at Parliament and the National Theatre, appears on radio and TV, including as host of BBC Radio 3's Free Thinking. She MCs for Museum's Show Off and performs comedy and cabaret as character Ada Camp, winning awards both for that and her work in theatre research and engagement. But fuck all that, she's a member of the Magic Circle, so let's reduce her down to just that point. Now, no, that wouldn't be fair. It would be like sawing the lady in half, or her CV at least. Please welcome the very complete Dr. Naomi Paxton.
Hello, thank you for that terrifyingly intimidating introduction. Thank you.
I had to leave stuff out, mate.
Sorry. I have got another fellowship though, actually. I'm a parliamentary academic fellow at the moment.
Oh, congratulations.
I just need to update the website, but thank you. Yeah, what? No, it's an intimidating, I think it's just called a portfolio career, and it just involves hustling in all directions for the past
years. What is a fellow?
It's interesting. Yeah, I don't know. It's different things in different places. It tends to mean a short-term contract, to be honest. So my associate fellowship at the School of Advanced Study, so I'm not paid, but it kind of gives me academic affiliation. My knowledge exchange fellowship at Central is part-time, and I'm there to do a particular job. And then my parliamentary fellowship, I'm there to work on a big international public engagement project, and that's for kind of a year and a half. So I guess it tends to mean short-term contract. Sometimes paid, sometimes not.
Wow, it's a fancy term for temping. Next time I'm doing reception. Yeah, I'm a fellow of this law firm. Now, listen, we have talked about the Magic Circle in the past, so you have lots of very impressive things, but it would be a shame for us to not ask you what it's like being a member of the Magic Circle. What is it? Or can you tell us?
Well, I've only been a member of the Magic Circle for about a month, to be honest.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. It just happened during lockdown. In fact, my second ever issue of the Magic Circular, which is their magazine, has arrived today, and it feels very posh. It's cool. I've actually just been made Equality, Diversion and Inclusion Officer for the Magic Circle, which is going to be interesting. But I can't wait to get back to the clubhouse, go to the clubhouse, get a membership card, go to the bar, just enjoy the kind of museum and meet everybody. Because online Zooms and stuff have been great. But I think the whole point of being a member, isn't it, is kind of working with other people and meeting other people. But yeah, I'm excited, actually. Yeah,
because I think people don't realize there is like there's a building in Euston and with a bar and stuff, and you can go and hang out there. It's it's a club.
It's not, Barry. It only looks like there's a building.
It's like Diagon Alley. There's a beautiful spiral staircase, and there's a museum, and then there's for the public, and then there's a secret museum for magicians only. I've never been in that one, so presumably I'll get to go in that one. And there's a little theatre and loads of stuff. But I've only ever been as a guest before, so my kind of memory of the whole building is hazy. But yeah, no, I'm very excited. And apparently it's all wheelchair accessible, which is very civilised. Well, you have to come. I'll take you on a Monday night.
If there's a theatre there, let's do a feckin' gig there, Ben. Although the way our World's Worst Magic Trick episode went, we'll have to make sure there are a few people who don't show up in case they've listened.
I imagine magicians are at least as bitchy as comedians.
So as no one's doing the Sands of the Desert fucking trick, then we're fine, I think. That was the one we decided as the worst ever, and the rest of them were all pretty okay with.
Yeah, I think a D&I job is going to be a challenge in some areas. Yeah. But, you know, I'm honoured to take it on.
We always ask our guests what they're worst at in the world. Clearly you're good at so many things, but is there a chink in your armour we need to be aware of?
So my wife says I'm worst at finding things in the house, which is true. I'm very good at finding things in real life, but in the house I kind of go into like meh mode and never can find anything in cupboards, and she always is shouting, "Big eyes!" at me. I'm really bad at being around waxworks.
Oh.
And I can't get over it intellectually. And I'm beginning to think I possibly should seek hypnotism or help of some kind.
I can't remember what the phobia is called, but there is a phobia of like statues and things that look like people. It's specifically the representations of people. It's not people themselves.
Yeah. No, it's waxworks. Although I am getting a bit jumpy with mannequins, so it's obviously getting worse. But I don't know why. Like, I never had a waxwork attack me as a child or anything. Like, I don't know what
you did
know.
You watch a lot of Doctor Who episodes?
And... No, it's on the telly. It was rubbish. But it's becoming a problem, especially when you kind of work with museums and you do stuff and you like to go around places and like historic houses and they have somebody in the corner looming. Yes. I get really jumpy. Jumpy.
It's a brilliant. Ben will know I'm a big fan of Annika Rice, the TV presenter, and the show Treasure Hunt, which she co-presented in the 80s. Yeah. They'd have a team in the studio solving clues and then directing Annika Rice, who was somewhere in the country in sort of 25-mile square area, being flown around by a helicopter from location to location to find the clues. And I have a vague feeling it's in Derby or Durham, in a castle somewhere, that she is looking around one of those living dioramas of like loads of waxworks at like a banquet table and a writing desk, and one of the waxworks comes alive and gives her the clue. Oh. And it's nearly shits herself on national television. It's so one of the funniest things I've ever seen.
The only caveat to this is that do you guys remember Rock Circus in Piccadilly Circus? Rock, am I too old? It was in the Trocadero.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I remember that.
It's like moving waxworks. I think if waxworks are really crap, I'm fine with them. So like when they were sort of moving really jerkily, that's okay. And I remember when I was an actor, I got a job presenting a travel guide for Taiwanese tourists to London. Don't ask me how I got this. Anyway, but I ended up standing at the top of the Sherlock Holmes Museum with my back to a load of waxworks, having to deliver this piece to camera. And I was scared, but they were so crap that part of me was scared. So maybe it's just good waxworks I'm scared of. So I should just go to really crap museums.
Yeah.
Well, you need to go to, what's his name? Louis Tussauds, out in Norfolk. He was Madame Tussauds' brother, son, uncle, one of the male relations.
The one they kept in the attic.
Yeah.
maybe he's doing a real life Dorian Gray though. Maybe like he makes terrible waxworks of people and in real life they get more handsome. So, you know, the more melty faced his version of Brad Pitt looks, the sexier Brad Pitt gets.
And I imagine somewhere in there is a really handsome waxwork of Nigel Farage.
Hello and welcome to Castable. This is a brand new podcast where we get amazing guests to come and pitch their dream music festival. I'm Matt Hoss and I'm the host. I'll be there to interview, to analyse and get to the depths of why they think their music festival is the best. We're going to be talking about music, camping and why we love the music that we do. It's a podcast looking at the things we love and why we love them. Download Castable today on Apple Podcasts, Spotify or Podbean. Join the festival today!
This week we are doing another Patreon episode for one of our very new donors. Hello, David Whitley. And David has entreated us to do an episode about the world's worst speech. So we are going to tinkle our glassware with tiny little bejeweled spoons, pray that a hush comes over the listening and watching audience, and let Barry stand and impress us with his findings.
Well, let's start with a famous one. Let's start with "We Will Fight Them on the Beaches," shall we? So everyone knows this theory that perhaps Churchill didn't do all his speeches and there was an actor called Norman Shelley who may have delivered them for them. And do you not know that?
I had no idea of this.
Okay. I thought everybody would know this theory. There is a suggestion that the broadcast versions of Churchill's speeches were recorded by an actor, Norman Shelley, who could do a mean Churchill impression. Norman Shelley was born in 1903, died in 1980. He was best known for his work on BBC Children's Hour. He had a recurring role in The Archers. His best known role was maybe as Winnie the Pooh in the Children's Hour adaptations of the A.A. Milne story. So he would have been that generation before Alan Bennett did his version. He'd have been the voice that people would have thought of as the definitive Winnie the Pooh. And he also played Gandalf and Tom Bombadil in a 1955 adaptation of The Lord of the Rings. And
there are stories that he could do a very good Churchill impression. His son, after he died, uncovered a recording on a 78 RPM BBC recording of him doing one of the speeches. It was from 1942, and We Will Fight Them From the Beaches was delivered in 1940, so it's not the same year. And according to another friend of his, Trevor Hill, who was a radio producer, he said that Shelley did indeed stand in for Churchill on at least three occasions, specifically when Churchill was ill or out of the country and wouldn't have been divulged at the time. Lots of people say this is not true, that he did not do Churchill for the radio broadcasts. And one of the reasons we know he didn't do We'll Fight Them on the Beaches is because it wasn't broadcast on the radio. Churchill read it out in the House of Commons, and then a BBC announcer read sections of it during the nightly news. You would have heard him delivering it, but that's because he made recordings of a lot of his speeches in 1949 for the benefit of posterity. Yeah, so the recordings you hear of Churchill, the famous recordings of Churchill doing those speeches, were delivered after the war had ended for some people to sell.
So hang on, you're telling me that after World War II, there was essentially a trade in Churchill's greatest hits going out?
Yeah, I think they were being sold by Decca by the 1980s. You know, it's big, big money. The thing is, as well, this speech wasn't particularly well received at the time. In the House of Commons, some members were moved to tears, but by no means all of them. It was after Dunkirk, the evacuation. So that was a humiliation in one sense. Churchill acknowledged in the speech that the French and Belgian campaign had been a colossal military disaster. The Labour MP Emmanuel Shinwell recalled, "We were very much depressed as a result of the events that led to him making this speech, and all his oratory could not remove that depression." His wife Clementine told a friend that a great section of the Tory party were not behind Winston and received his great speech even in sullen silence. And the Ministry of Information reported on the domestic morale, "The grave tone of Churchill's speech made some impression and may have contributed in some measure to a rather pessimistic atmosphere of today. The contents of the speech were on the whole expected, but some apprehension has been caused throughout the country on account of the PM's reference to fighting alone. This has led to some slight increase in doubt about the intentions of our ally, France." Not only that, but the famous bit of the speech, the bit we know, "We'll fight them on the beaches, we will never surrender," all of that stuff. That's not the important bit of the speech. After he says, "We will never surrender," he says, "And even if, which I do not for a moment believe, this island or a large part of it were subjugated and starving, then our empire beyond the seas, armed and guarded by the British fleet, would carry on the struggle until, in God's good time, the new world, with all its power and might, steps forth to the rescue and the liberation of the old." This is a direct plea to America to come and help Britain in the war, but with reassurance requested by Roosevelt that the British fleet wouldn't surrender to the Germans. The British fleet would decamp to Canada or South Africa or Australia, to one of the British dominions, and continue fighting the war, because the British fleet was an important part of any involvement of the Americans in the war effort.
Are you telling me that we have once again misremembered our own historical narrative to serve our own very self-congratulatory ends as a nation?
He was also a massive racist, so yes.
Was he?
And a real arse to women.
And a real arse to women, yeah. It is likely that Shelley did some recordings of Churchill for some American propaganda films, and may have recorded some of these discs again after the war, but there isn't any concrete evidence that he delivered speeches on radio during the war. Certainly when one of the people who is arguing that he did and wants to denigrate Churchill is the historian and Holocaust denier David Irving, it does tend to make you want to believe the opposite of whatever he says.
It does. Well, I mean, I don't know if you know this, Barry, but during the Falklands War, quite a few of Margaret Thatcher's speeches were performed by Patricia Routledge.
Oh my God, they need to remake The Iron Lady immediately.
They do. Well, no, because she's so used to going, "No, no, 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 no. It may be written bucket, but it's pronounced bouquet." And she'd say, "It may be written Las Malvinas, but it's actually pronounced."
Yeah. Very good. I read about some long political speeches as well. India's former finance minister, V.K. Krishna Menon, gave a speech at the United Nations, which is listed in the Guinness Book of Records as the longest ever UN speech. He explained India's position on Kashmir over the course of 7 hours.
During that speech, he basically collapsed, had to be taken away, and then brought back with a doctor by the side as he continued to do the speech, checking his blood pressure.
That's amazing. Wow. Like one of those like the big long Isner-Mahout match at Wimbledon a few years ago.
Yeah, after 1957, speeches at the UN had to go to a tiebreak after a couple of hours.
Well, 1960, Fidel Castro was there. He spoke for 4 hours and 29 minutes, not his longest speech on record. In 1986, he spoke in Havana for 7 hours and 10 minutes at the Communist Party Congress. Stuart Stevenson, in 2004, a Scottish parliamentarian, delivered a speech lasting 23 hours and 51 minutes on International Suicide Prevention Week. People like to talk about the filibuster in the US Congress. If people sort of hold up Ted Cruz in 2013, he spoke for 21 hours and 19 minutes trying to hold up Obamacare, the health insurance policy, or certainly spoke against it. And his speech was obviously aided by the fact that members of his party are able to interrupt and ask questions to buy him more time. But it's not the longest filibuster ever. In fact, there's three longer than it. Wayne Morse, an independent from Oregon, spoke in 1953 for 22 and a half hours on the Submerged Lands Act. Alphonse D'Amato in 1986, Republican of New York, spoke for 23 and a half hours on the Defense Authorization Act, brackets 1987 amendment. And famous white supremacist Strom Thurmond spoke in 1957 against the Civil Rights Act for over 24 hours. You have to really hate black people to have to speak for over a day to try and prevent them getting, you know, rights and stuff. Then I went to the other extreme. I found short speeches, and particularly short Oscar speeches. Alfred Hitchcock took 20 seconds to cross the stage to accept the Irving G. Thalberg Memorial Award in 1968, but only took 6 seconds to speak, saying, "Thank you," pause, "very much indeed." Master of suspense, even in his own speeches. In 1991... Wow. Joe Pesci, I think trying to stop himself from crying, said, "It's my privilege, thank you," mere 5 words when he won Best Supporting Actor for Goodfellas. William Holden won Best Actor in 1954 for Stalag 17, and he said, thank you," which he could have cut it to just "thank you," which Patty Duke did when she won for The Miracle Worker in 1963. Both Patty Duke and the director of The Cove in 2010, Louis Sayhoyos, both said just "thank you" when they took home an Academy Award. The reason Sayhoyos spoke for such a short time is he had 45 seconds, but his fellow producer Fisher Stevens spoke for most of it. So when the microphone finally came around to him, he only got 2 words out before the orchestra started playing. He released a video online of his intended speech the next day.
Oh, I mean, that's a bit like being played off. Have you, Naomi, have you ever had that happen to you? Have you been played off?
Oh, yeah. I had one awful gig in South London where I'd been booked for a night that was being tried out, and it was great, and it was cash in hand, and it was brilliant. I got there to the gig, and it was already chaotic, and I ended up going on stage about 2.5 hours later than planned. Everyone was rancidly drunk. No one was listening, and they couldn't work out how to turn the music off that was already playing in the bar. My act is quite shouty anyway, but I was really struggling because people were just not listening, and they couldn't hear me at all. And then I've been booked to do 40 minutes. At 7 minutes in, the guy who was running the night just came up to me, literally grabbed the mic out of my mouth and went, "Great, thank you very much for stopping that." And then they just gave up. Wow. And I just went and hid. I went and hid in the little backstage cupboard I was in, going, "Oh my God, that was dreadful." And then he came through with like notes of money. And so I just scuttled off into the dark.
Get
but yeah,
there.
I was played off before I'd even got on.
Yeah. So if any of us ever win an Oscar, the note to set a record, by the way, is just to say thanks or cheers. One word hasn't been done yet, so the opportunity is there. Before I get to my choice, I did want to mention the speech that former British Prime Minister Theresa May gave at the Tory Party conference, the Conservative Party conference on October the 3rd, 2017, which for our non-British listeners, annual event, the party get together, a bit like having the Republican or Democrat convention. They have one of these every year. They all get to be together, and the Prime Minister gives a big keynote speech, and all of the sycophants in the party stand up with stopwatches and applaud for a predetermined amount of time. And Theresa May was in a bit of a fragile position already at the time. Brexit was looming, and there was lots of infighting in the cabinet, and she'd lost her majority because she'd held a snap election, thinking she was going to expand it, and everything went wrong. A British comedian.
Simon Brodkin,
that's right. He's famous for conducting practical jokes. I think he's the one who threw money at Sepp Blatter at his press conference
once. Yeah, and he gave Donald Trump golf balls with swastikas on them.
Excellent.
And I was talking to someone about that the other night. It was being broadcast on Facebook, and apparently as soon as the swastika came out, Facebook cut the feed. Because turns out Facebook is really good at noticing when pretend Nazis are on there, but not when the goddamn real ones are.
Oh, well. Well, Simon approached her while she was giving her speech a few minutes into it and handed her a P45, the pink slip, I think they say in America. Then Theresa May, who had a bit of a cold, her vocal cords just basically packed in. She was coughing, rasping, whispering through the entire speech. One of the members of the cabinet, I think, gave her a glass of water. She got a round of applause for drinking from it. It's not great if that's the thing you're being applauded for. But to top it all off, the sign behind her said, "Building a country that works for everyone." And some of the letters from the sign started to drop off during the speech. I mean, given the word country was in the phrase, she got away with it. The O stayed up for long enough. But yeah, the reactions to the new speech were not great. One Conservative minister summarised his response in the Sun newspaper as, "What the fucking fuck, 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 fuck." I want to offer forward my option. It's not a political speech, and I'm sure there will be some political speeches mentioned from you guys, but I did read about the longest speeches ever. The world record for the longest speech marathon is 90 hours and 2 minutes by a guy called Ananta Ram KC of Nepal in Kathmandu, set in 2018. He started his attempt at 6:15 a.m. on the 27th of August, finished at 12:17 a.m. on the 31st, and he maintained a silence for 7 days beforehand as part of his preparations for it. But he's not my choice, because a few years earlier, in 2014, a Florida pastor called Zach Zender spoke for 53 hours and 18 minutes to set a then world record. Now, he did raise $90,000 for, I believe, local charities. That was what the whole point of it was. But church sermons can go on a bit anyway. Not only does he speak for that length of time, he came prepared with 200 pages of notes and I think this is the kicker, 600 PowerPoint slides.
Oh, that's a bit much.
PowerPoint at the best of times, not ideal. PowerPoint over the course of 56 hours with 600 slides. That's an average of more than 10 slides an hour. He had people there to listen to him. He wasn't just doing the speech, you know, uninterrupted. He had a congregation there who were there to help keep him awake, basically, to, you know, chip in with responses to the sermon, but also they had water guns in case anyone fell asleep. He had one he could shoot. He could shoot the congregation. They had them to shoot him. You're apparently, according to Guinness World Records, you're allowed 5 minute breaks. So the members keep track of these 5 minute breaks, which sort of turn out to be an awkward experience because all these people are watching him. They know his bathroom breaks and all of this stuff. They cheer for him where he comes back. And they listen to the sermon in shifts because Guinness rules say that 10 people have to be present for the speech to count.
That is true, because I've been part of a successful attempt for the world's longest comedy gig, and we were sort of passing the baton shift to shift, and I did the 3 a.m. shift. And let me tell you, trying to do crowd work with people who've been awake for 24 hours at 3 o'clock in the morning is a thankless task.
The previous record had been 48 hours, 31 minutes, and he passed that, and then kept going for 5 more hours, as I said. Apparently, according to a TV report, re-energized, Zender kept talking for another 5 hours.
No!
Why would you let him do that?
God, I mean, he makes Ken Dodd look like he's just giving small haikus.
Yeah. He sat, he stood, he walked on a treadmill to help keep him awake. And the crowd did start to count him down when they got to the thing. In fact, you can hear a soundbite of where he goes, "Here we go, unidentified crowd. 3, 2, 1, Zender. We did it. Applause." I mean, a worthy cause, raising money for an addiction centre and all of that. But long speeches, world record attempts in general just wang me off when they're not in like the field of sporting achievement. And particularly when it's having to sit through... having to sit through a sermon with 600 PowerPoint slides, I will remind you.
Sermons are not a great piece of public speaking generally, but any time a pastor goes, and I have brought out my spreadsheet, and I brought out my PowerPoint display.
Yeah.
At least a rabbi cannot do that because no computers on a Sabbath.
Yeah, exactly.
Keith, keeping on brand, obviously, I was thinking as a suffrage historian, I should look for speeches in Hansard, which is the record of what's said in the Commons and the Lords. There are so many potentially said by Liberal MPs and Tory Lords during the 1910s, particularly around forcible feeding, for example, women in World War One, and suffrage campaigning generally. I did have a small, I didn't know if worst interpretation of speech would be a thing. It did pop into, when we were getting married, myself and my wife, we had a dear friend of ours who came up to read a poem, and she read that poem, Us Two, which is like a Winnie the Pooh poem, which is wherever I go, there's always poo, me. I didn't realise till afterwards, my wife thought she was talking about poo. I thought she was making some sort of like hippy dippy point about kind of bodily functions and about grounding yourself.
Oh wow.
At our wedding, Barry's husband, Mikey, read The Owl and the Pussycat, and it turns out saying, oh pussy, oh pussy, oh pussy, my love, what a wonderful pussy you are, with 120 congregants looking back at you, it's quite an impressive thing to keep as straight a face as Mikey did.
Yeah,
that is brilliant. So I'm not going to pick that one, so I've narrowed it down to two, but I know which one I'm going to pick. So obviously I look at the kind of the history of theatre professionals who supported votes for women, but you have kind of had to look at the wider opposition really of what was going on. And there's this charming man called Lord Curzon of Kedleston, who was one of the presidents of the National Anti-Suffrage Society. I think it's the National Society for Opposing Women's Suffrage, anyway. And he printed a brilliant, well, he made a speech in 1909 and printed a fantastic pamphlet afterwards called 15 Good Reasons Against the Grant of Female Suffrage, which is just genius. Each of the 15 reasons, as you can imagine, are solidly thought out. They're ridiculous and they're super fun. But the one I've chosen is his speech that he made in 1918, January 1918, the final debate in the House of Lords around the Representation of the People Act. And he, having been a confirmed anti-suffragist, you know, throughout all the 1910s and saying ridiculous things in Parliament, he then gives this epically long speech. I'm sorry that I don't know how long it was, but you have to scroll, keep scrolling down a lot to get to the bottom, full of nonsense, absolute nonsense. It's the kind of best case of whataboutery. It's like reading a very well articulated sort of Facebook thread of people you don't know at 3 a.m. with kind of all kinds of bonkers things in it. But then at the end, this is mad, he says, therefore, my lords, I cannot vote either way upon this amendment, for I am loath to assume the responsibility of embark upon a course which I might not be able to pursue. So having done this for years, he then abstains from the final vote on the Representation of the People Act, which then obviously passes. But I just think that's the worst speech for me, because not only does he not really defend his points, but he takes ages to not really defend them. And then at the very end, having been one of the strongest anti-suffragists and most prominent, he goes, I'm not going to vote either way on this amendment.
So I nominate
Curzon of Kedleston on the 10th of January 1918 in the House of Lords for worst speech.
Curzon of Kedleston?
Kedleston, K-E-D-L-E-S-T-O-N.
Right, just because when you were saying it was Curzon of Kedleston, I was like, does he live in Balamori? He sounds adorable.
Former Viceroy of India, and he's problematic in loads of ways. But his first like one for the 1909, the 15 Good Reasons Against the Grant of Female Suffrage is... political activity will tend to take away woman from her proper sphere and highest duty, which is maternity. So, you know, that's his first reason for women not having the vote, is that somehow voting once a year, and they already had the vote, the municipal vote, voting once in the national election would take them so far away from their children that it would be unconscionable.
Still all those adverts that were really not very far from the Harry Enfield sketch of women know your limits, and that I'm sure there was stuff during the 1910s of essentially if a woman does too much political thinking, then her brain will overheat and it'll be a detriment to her health.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, we've got stuff in here as well about intellectual emancipation, and it's bonkers. And there's so much good stuff, bad stuff, the Home Secretary says during World War One about women not being allowed to drive cars because it wouldn't be safe for them to do so on the streets, which is clearly a problem that the Home Secretary should be sorting out. Don't blame the victim. Mm. And also that people wouldn't have confidence in them as drivers, despite the fact they're running entire hospital corps and driving ambulances all across Europe.
Yeah.
So there's a special kind of disconnect when it comes to this stuff.
I think a lot of people think that you think of the suffragettes and you think of sort of individual women throwing themselves in front of horses or tying themselves to railings. And actually, they have these massive like monster meetings and like speech, like marches in Trafalgar Square and speeches being given and all the sort of stuff you'd associate with a proper protest movement.
I mean, literally, the kind of three biggest Edwardian crazes were vegetarianism, roller skating, and jiu-jitsu, and the suffragettes were all over them.
Yeah.
How does one do jiu-jitsu whilst on roller skates?
I'm sure they could do it. I don't know if they did jiu-jitsu and roller skating at the same time, but roller skating and vegetarianism happened pretty much at the same time. During the census boycott of 1918, when they left the Aldwych Rinkeries at 3 a.m. They were staying out all night to protest the census. Left the Aldwych Rinkeries and went around the corner to have a breakfast in a vegetarian restaurant on Drury Lane, and then went back round and skated until daybreak. Super cool.
That's my type of protest.
There's one throwing at the horse. There's like a couple of railing things. Yeah. And there are lots of mass meetings, but there's also lots of super cool, really fun, creative, kind of immersive stuff. It's just, it's a goodness, the whole suffrage movement. It's really interesting, actually.
Yeah.
It's one of those interesting things. I wonder whether you know how it's so easy for the powers that be to characterise any protest, say, for example, the ones that have been happening over the past couple of months, and they just focus in on the things that look most militant, because you know that'll make sure that it scares the horses and we maintain the status quo. Whereas actually, for example, going back to the American civil rights movement in the 60s and 70s, the Black Panthers were goddamn amazing, and the Black Panthers did all sorts of brilliant health and welfare and literacy programs, but you don't get taught any of that in school. In school, the best that you get about the Black Panthers is they had guns and they wore military uniforms, next lesson. And it's this, I feel like it's the same with the suffragettes and the suffragists. We hear all about them chucking themselves in front of horses and lobbing bricks through windows, which was great and necessary, but none of this creative stuff that you're telling us about.
It's interesting, isn't it? It's the whole, we've seen that a lot, the kind of the right way to protest. Like, you're not doing this properly. Please go through the proper channels, which is basically kind of passing the buck. You know, write a letter and come back, you know, sit quietly and then we'll come back to you in 6 months, which is what the suffrage campaigners were taught. They first sent their petition in like 1866. And so we've been going for like 50 years. But there's also a way of kind of highlighting inarticulacy and negativity, I think. So if you're very much focusing on bodies in pain, you know, or of inarticulate women throwing things and expressing themselves by, you're therefore not then listening to what they're saying. And we're seeing that a lot as well when we look at how kind of anti-government protests are documented in the media. And that was very much happening kind of in the very early 1900s. The press was really important part of the suffrage campaign, and so much of that was successful because it made press headlines. But what it did do is suppress some of the reasons they were doing what they were doing, particularly around, for example, prison or forcible feeding. It's really interesting why they were doing that. If we just focus on their actions and we don't hear why, then actually the point of that protest becomes lost, and that's kind of what people want when they want to suppress discussions around progress.
There are very few recordings of speeches, you know, prior to the First World War, but there is a recording of Christabel Pankhurst from 1909 in the British Library, and the accompanying commentary from it, which is written by a man, it has to be said, notes that it's a bit stilted, it's very carefully scripted and not particularly sort of, you know, fire and brimstone delivery. But actually, in a world where all the suffragettes have been depicted as mad, hell-raising women, it's the Hillary Clinton thing of having to appear more calm and more measured and more, and, you know, let your poshness come through and let your well-spokenness come through and try and appear reasoned to try and counter
totally
that idea. Yeah.
That whole thing about maternity, which Lord Curzon says in 1909. So in 1909, there's this huge suffrage exhibition at a skating rink. in Kensington that have been used for the 1908 Olympics, actually. And there's this huge exhibition. They have it for a couple of weeks. Super cool. There's a theatre there. They have immersive prison cell spaces where you can kind of go in and talk to suffragettes prisoners. So it's really beautiful. And all kinds of stuff for sale. But then they have all these crafts that women are doing. So they're selling all this stuff for suffrage, like baby clothes and jewellery and fruit and produce. And it's a real constructing of womanhood, because a lot of the rhetoric around suffrage is these sort of old hairy lesbian spinsters in pork pie hats, you know. and there's a real kind of counter protest of, in fact, you get postcards of prominent suffrage campaigners kind of pictured at home washing the baby or in the kitchen, just to try and counteract these kind of negative ideas that somehow everything you've been taught as a woman. And of course, the education system is hugely part of that. Women are taught needlework, for example, as part of their schooling, that somehow that makes you lesser. So then there's a real embracing of that. So rather than being critical of the people they're trying to talk to, they're going, we're embracing what you actually, you know, what you have been taught to do and what you do as part of your domestic lives. And we're just asking you to kind of think about how you zoom out from that and how that, how you're represented in the wider world. But yeah, it's curious that then we have these really brilliant suffrage campaigners who are then kind of in their pinny in their kitchen, you know, doing the washing in order to prove that they're not monsters who just shout at people all the time. It's interesting, once you begin to look back at these movements and if you, you know, and you look at the actual people involved, you find that, you know, people are people. But that was always a shocker, isn't it, when you look back at history and go, what, they had lives?
Yeah, they were as grubby and mixed up, as contradictory and hypocritical as we were.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, that's made me think of, in 1992, when Bill Clinton was running for president against George H.W. Bush, there were accusations that he'd steered favourable contracts to Hillary's law firm when he was governor of Arkansas. And Hillary said, she explained that she had ambitions outside being the traditional first lady and wife role that was reserved for, you know, governor's wives at the time. She said, I suppose I could have stayed home and baked cookies and had teas, but what I decided to do was fulfill my profession, which I entered before my husband was in public life. This, of course, being American in the early 90s, provoked a massive backlash, including letters to Time magazine in 1992. If I ever entertained the idea of voting for Bill Clinton, the smug bitchiness of his wife's comment has nipped that notion in the bud, because that's a reasonable way to think about politics. And someone else said, I resent the implication that those of us who stay at home just bake cookies. We hardly have the time. And with that, a new contest was born. The Family Circle magazine presidential cookie poll. Family Circle started a bake-off, and Hillary Clinton had to play along with Barbara Bush, George H.W.'s wife. So Hillary submitted a recipe for oatmeal chocolate chip cookies made with shortening, and Barbara Bush submitted her more traditional chocolate chip cook recipe, no oatmeal and with butter. Hillary's cookie won the vote. And meaningless as it may seem, editors at the magazine were able to claim the contest has led to correctly calling election winners all but once. In the 24 years between 1992 and 2016, Cindy McCain beat Michelle Obama in 2008. Like, if you like, the suffragettes having to be pictured with the baby at home or whatever, having to then play that role in order to pacify some of the more traditional people looking at her and wondering what she's trying to actually achieve.
Yes, I suppose there's some comfort in the fact that it's, you know, systemic.
Yes. Yes, that is the comfort we can draw from that.
Well done on finding the rainbow lining on that dark, dark cloud. I'll give my first word to Salvador Dali. He gave a speech in 1980 at the age of 76. He'd been in seclusion for 6 months, but he came forward to a press conference and said, I shall be so brief that I have already finished, and then walked off stage.
Oh, Dali, you card.
Yeah, it's good, isn't it?
Yeah.
I had a look at a couple of speeches that were not given. Obviously, Barry, you wrote a play, the first, all about or inspired by the speech that Nixon had ready to go in case the moon landing failed, and you did it for a landing on Mars. Mm-hmm. Well, in 2013, documents released about a planned speech for Queen Elizabeth II to say in 1983 as part of a civil-military exercise of what would happen if a nuclear war broke out.
Oh, yeah.
And it was written as if to be broadcast on March the 4th, 1983, and it begins with references to the horrors of war, the madness, and people having to be prepared to survive against the great odds. I mean, she could, honestly, she can dust this off and give it as a Christmas message this year. although the one bit that will have dated is she speaks of families about the common fear they all shared and how much she shares the same fear for her son, Andrew. I mean, well, the message ends, my message to you is therefore simple. Help those who cannot help themselves. Give comfort to the lonely and the homeless, and let your family be the focus of hope and life to those who need it. As we strive together to fight off the new evil, let us pray for our country and men of goodwill wherever they may be. God bless you all. Anyway, I'm off down to the Buckingham Palace bunker for sandwiches. Best of luck to you all, plebs.
I'd like to think that even after she's dead, they'll still get the Queen to record those speeches.
Yeah. Mate, she's been dead for a decade and a half.
Yeah.
She's just being operated by Andy Serkis. That's a conspiracy. I want to pop out into the world. The queen isn't a lizard. She's just Andy Serkis in a body stocking. Eisenhower similarly had a speech prepared if the D-Day landings failed, and he tendered his resignation. Specifically, he was going to take personal responsibility if the landings had failed. And it's for me, obviously, is like the pair of you, a bunch of pinko lefty humans. Eisenhower is my favourite Republican president. He just seems such a thoroughly decent human. Given like so, because Eisenhower is the man who coined the term military-industrial complex, and he coined it as a warning, as a man who was the general of operations in World War II, and was like, don't let these ciphers in suits have control of our country, and yet now they have. Again, another thing that very much impresses me about Mr. President Eisenhower. Talking of more presidents, we need to have a little talk about William Henry Harrison.
There we go. I knew one of us would get to him.
He has the dual title of the longest ever inauguration speech, contrasted with the shortest ever time in office.
Yeah.
On March the 4th, 1841, he delivered it. It was so long. It was 8,445 words long. And it was a long, rambling exposition of the role of government within anecdotes about Greco-Roman history. And it went on and on. And he apparently had a little bit of booze to keep him warmed through the snowstorm that was happening. So he became more and more incoherent as it went on. And after the speech, he went to the White House and he stood outside and greeted well-wishers without wearing a coat or a hat. And just 32 days later, he dropped dead of pneumonia.
Yeah. For comparison, you said his speech was an hour and 45 minutes and 8,445 words. Trump's American Carnage inauguration speech was 16 minutes long and 1,433 words. But I would say felt longer. And yeah. That's some really weird shit, I think, is what George W. Bush is reported to have said about it.
I mean, say what you like about George W. Bush, but he knows how to cut to the nub of
an
issue.
He really does. Are you going to talk about Andrew Johnson?
No, talk to me about Andrew Johnson.
Okay, so Andrew Johnson was Lincoln's vice president for about like a month, then ended up being president because Lincoln was assassinated. I think he replaced Hannibal Hamlin, which is an excellent vice president name. He was a southerner in favor of preserving the nation. So I think Lincoln thought it was sort of a unifying figure, get a southerner on the ticket, along with Lincoln being from, I think, Illinois. And so he arrived in Washington, Johnson, summoned to come and join the ticket with typhoid fever. So he tried to treat that by drinking lots of whiskey. He'd had about three tumblers of it before speaking at his inauguration. Apparently, the Michigan Senator Zachariah Chandler later wrote to his wife, "The inauguration went off very well, except that the vice president-elect was too drunk to perform his duties." Apparently, highlights of the address include a moment where he called out cabinet members by name and demanded they never forget the power came from the people. And then Hamlin, the guy he was replacing, tried to yank on Johnson's coat to get him to stop, but Johnson kept talking. Not only that, as he worked his way along the cabinet, apparently he called out in a stage whisper, "What is the name of the Secretary of the Navy?" He was then asked to perform his duty after he was sworn in of swearing in the new senators to the Senate, but he was so disorientated apparently he had to be relieved of the task.
Oh no.
There is some questions about whether this is all true or not, but certainly seems to have been a thoroughly dislikable man. Even sober, he tried to, you know, he vetoed civil rights bills and was replaced on the ticket by the Republicans, by Ulysses S. Grant, for the next election. Have you got Isaac Newton as well?
Yes, Isaac Newton was a member of Parliament.
Yes, he was.
He only had one speech that he ever gave in the Houses of Parliament, and I believe it ran to the length of, "Can someone close that window? There's a breeze in here."
Yeah, essentially that. The thing is, he discovered gravity and all of that nonsense and published his books on calculus and all of that in his early 20s. He'd really peaked far too soon.
It's like Noel Gallagher with, you know, he'd released the first two Oasis albums by the time he was 30.
Yeah. Or like Eric Bristow.
Yeah. Weeping because there were no more lands to conquer.
Yeah.
You talked before about speeches to the UN. Obviously, famously, Fidel Castro liked to bang on there, as did the Libyan leader, Colonel Gaddafi.
Yes.
Who in 2009 turned up and declared it should not be called the Security Council, it should be called the Terror Council. And basically, he hadn't been allowed to speak at the UN for 40 years. And we found out why in this 100-minute speech that sort of was like a foreshadowing of Trump, really. He accused the United States of developing swine flu. He questioned the official record of the Kennedy assassination. He likened the UN Council to Al-Qaeda. My favourite thing about him, though, is that when he turned up in New York, the New York Council forbade him from setting up a Bedouin tent outside the UN. So instead, he made camp outside Trump Tower.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
The more I read about Colonel Gaddafi, the more I feel like he's a professional wrestling character who just got out of hand.
Do you remember the story when Ian Paisley interrupted the Pope at the European Parliament?
What?
So Ian Paisley was an MEP, former leader of the Democratic Unionist Party and First Minister of Northern Ireland, Ian Paisley. He was a member of the European Parliament, and in 1988... interrupted a speech being given by Pope John Paul II in the European Parliament by shouting, "I denounce you as the Antichrist," and holding up a poster reading, "Pope John Paul II, Antichrist." I didn't think the line between Ian Paisley and Sinead O'Connor was as, you know, short short as it is, but there we are. Other MEPs jeered at Paisley, threw papers at him and snatched his poster, and he produced another one, so he clearly planned for it.
Wow.
And he was admonished by parliamentary president, whose name was Lord Plum, who formally excluded him, and he then had to be forcibly ejected from the chamber. He said he was injured by other MEPs, saying people sort of hit him and threw things at him.
That's a hell of a heckle to the Pope. I hope the Pope just returned fire to Paisley. He went, "Listen, I don't come down to your job and knock the cocks out of your mouth on a Saturday night."
I mean, he did say he thought the European Union was a part of a conspiracy to create a Roman Catholic superstate controlled by the Vatican.
Pope said that.
Paisley did. And he claimed in an article that seat number 666 in the European Parliament was reserved for the Antichrist.
I'll phrase this gently. I had no idea Ian Paisley was that nuts.
Oh, yeah.
No, when did I?
Yeah, man.
Wow.
That's pretty impressive stuff. Just one and a half more things to talk about before my suggestion. Briefly, I should say, if we're going to talk historically in terms of impact, I think the speech by Pope Urban II to declare the First Crusade can go down as one of history's most destructive speeches.
Yeah,
I've got a small transcript from him here. It reads, "Kill them, kill them all."
Then Ian Paisley popped up holding a sign.
The Antichrist.
Was that Ian Paisley in his incarnation as the seventh Doctor Who?
Yeah. Wow, that would be a hell of a left turn for the whole series, wouldn't it? Russell T Davies. I would insist that they wear like a scarf that is patterned in the pattern Paisley as well. They'd be really on the nose. They have to be really on the nose with all of it. It's the Doctor. No, I'm the Reverend.
Yeah.
Maybe that's how the Master comes back.
Yes.
Sacha Dhawan is trapped, and now Ian Paisley comes back as the Master.
Hell of a plot twist. Oh, I'm here for this.
The last thing I want to talk about is, it's not really a speech as in a speech being given, but if we're going to talk about bad speech, we should talk about Reverend William Archibald Spooner, the warden of New College in Oxford, who was apparently, but I think mostly apocryphally, prone to the mistake of mixing up words. So, for example, instead of saying "the Lord is a loving shepherd," saying "the Lord is a shoving leopard." That he is most famous for, and that he happily claims, is a reference to a hymn, and he described it as the kinkering kongs their titties take, is what he said by mistake.
What was he meant to say?
Conquering kings their cities take.
There we go.
See, we needed a professional academic to get us out of that quagmire.
Yes. Yeah. It was all worthwhile.
Other ones that he may but may not have said is it kissed Marie to cuss the bride? Instead of a well-oiled bicycle, a well-boiled icicle. This one must be made up. "You have hissed all my mystery lectures. You have tasted a whole worm. Please leave Oxford on the next town drain."
He taught in Oxford rather than Cambridge, did he? I'm just thinking how dangerous it would be if he offered to take someone out on the cam in a punt.
Yeah. Yes, very good. Yeah, he taught at Oxford. And the other thing that I looked at briefly was gobbledygook and nonsense. My least favourite thing to do as an improviser is have to do gobbledygook scenes. It just irritates me. So the word gibberish may come from one or two places. It's either a variant of a word from the Romani language, meaning language or tongue, or it may, because it's got the words G-I-B or G-I-B in it, it may come from an 8th century Muslim Persian alchemist called Jabir ibn Hayyan, whose name was Latinized to Jaber. And so gibberish or jaberish was the reference incomprehensible technical jargon that is the sort of things that alchemists may have said. There's also one of the theories that it may come from Irish, because you've got gob or gab for your mouth. Gabbiness could turn to jibbiness and jabbiness as well. And then gobbledygook was a term coined later on by a former congressman of Texas and a former mayor of San Antonio, a chap called Murray Maverick. And he was the chairman of the Smaller War Plants Corporation during World War II. And he sent a memorandum saying, be short and use plain English. Stay off the gobbledygook language. So gobbledygook, just a made-up word. Murray Maverick is next to Dickens and Shakespeare as a man who made up words.
A bit about gobbledygook, just because it reminded me. There was a performer who was sometimes called Professor Stanley Unwin. He was a British comedian, actor and comic writer who used to do Unwinese, which was basically gobbledygook, which I think he performs. If you've ever seen the Carry On film Carry On Regardless, he's in that and he does that act. But apparently, just the thing I really liked about it is he just ad-libbed it on a recording using some microphone equipment, and it was sent to some BBC producers and they added some sound effects and was broadcast on a programme and received some positive response, and they wrote another sketch. And Stanley Unwin got some fan mail. His first ever letter of fan mail came from Joyce Grenfell, the amazing comedian, who was one of his absolute heroes. And that encouraged him to break into show business, to keep working. And he worked with the likes of Frankie Howard and June Whitfield and Kenneth Williams and so on.
And also, if you want to listen to Stanley Unwin, possibly the best and most accessible way is the Small Faces, their album Ogden's Nut Gone Flake, which, from my point of view, has a great opening track and then very much goes downhill after that. But the second half, and this is so psychedelic 60s, is a sound collage story involving nonsense from Stanley Unwin interspersing in their songs about the story of Happiness Stan. And it is, you'll enjoy listening to it once, I think, is the best way I can describe it.
He's buried in a churchyard next to his wife, Frances, who predeceased him, and their gravestone bears the epitaph, "Reunite in the heavenly bode, deep joy."
Oh, that's lovely.
This is nice, yeah.
There's a Russian singer and accordionist called Evelyn Petrova, and she has an album called The Year's Cycle, where she just, and there's a couple of tracks in it, where it sounds like she's just growling and screaming and going, and playing the accordion. And it just makes me uncontrollably laugh. It makes me feel slightly mad, like in a really nice way, because it's just so free and bonkers. Yeah. And you can find videos of her performing it, and she's just, you can just kind of see her squeezing this accordion and then like, the energy of it is just golden, golden.
That is not too far from my suggestion, which is, it's not technically a speech, it's more of a song, but it is composed by a chap called Adriano Celentano, who is an Italian performer from the 70s, and the song is called Prisen Colinen Sinaine Kiosol, and it is basically a gobbledygook song which is meant to sound to its Italian audience as if it's sung in English with an American accent reminiscent of Bob Dylan. And it's basically an Italian taking the piss out of Bob Dylan's Hoover with a bit of grit stuck in its singing style.
Oh,
and the
God.
Only word that you can hear throughout it is the phrase, all right. The thing that I dislike about it so much is that it's not, as it should be, a comedy song, but he deliberately wrote it to explore communication barriers. As he says, ever since I started singing, I was very influenced by American music. So at a certain point, because I like American slang, which for a singer is much easier to sing than Italian, I thought I'd write a song which would only have its theme the inability to communicate. And to do this, I had to write a song where the lyrics didn't mean anything.
Is it basically like Rennie and Renata doing Save Your Love?
Yeah.
Or Shut Up Your Face? It's just... These are the... It's like the Italian return fire version of that.
Yeah, it is. Because I got to it by looking at something called glossolalia, which is basically the posh word for speaking in tongues. And I was tempted to have speaking in tongues as my world's worst speech because, you know, a bunch of evangelists pretending that the Spirit of the Lord is coming through them. And what's happening? The Lord is talking shite. but I discovered this on glossolalia, and obviously ruining the fine heritage of Mr. Dylan goes against every fibre of my being. But when you're doing it with a made-up language, that really irritated me. So
I worked in Romania for a while doing puppetry with kids in orphanages, and I met this boy. He had echolalia, so he would repeat back to you what you'd say. It was really distressing to realise that that's how you sound and that's how you laugh.
Oh, so he would parrot you back to you?
Yeah.
Yeah, he would, like, and then eventually when he got comfortable, then you could have a conversation with him. But, like, you'd be in the car and you'd say, like, hello, and he'd go, hello. And then, how are you? How are you? And then you'd laugh or something, and he'd mimic your laugh, and you'd be like, oh my God, I actually sound like that. It was like having vocal coaching again from drama school. Yeah, really interesting. Yes, I haven't really looked it up much, but I just remember sitting in the back of class with him, laughing, and then him kind of creepily, back to Doctor Who, midnight.
Oh, well, our nomination for the world's worst speech then is a small boy from Romania that Naomi met.
Bless him.
So, our nominations for the world's worst speech are Barry's pastor, Zach Zendor, with his 2-and-a-bit-day marathon sermon with slides, Naomi's fence-sitting misogynist, Lord Curzon of Kettlestone, and my Dylan-aping Italian gobbledygookist, Adriano Celentano. Lovely work, everyone. We have gone past, present, and... Well, not the future, just past, present, and then more past.
Well done, everyone, for not taking any stops in Nuremberg, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. That almost
kudos
goes without
all
saying on
every
almost,
podcast.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to choose Adriano because, as I sort of said, his is not really a speech, but I found it wound me up and I needed to choose him. So I'm torn because I really like, Naomi, your logic for why you don't like Curzon, because I really enjoyed the sort of pitying tone you gave him a century on as an emancipated woman, just going, mate, if you're gonna hate us, stick to your guns.
Yeah.
To the fact that what I love about it is not that it's a bad speech, is that it's just a flaccid speech with no foundation. And yet, I think you and me, Naomi, could sit through it. Whereas I challenge you to sit through a 55-hour sermon with slides, followed by a 5-hour encore.
And water guns. And,
yeah, no, I think that's a clear winner.
And the onus on you being to track the piss regime of the guy giving the speech to you.
I just don't think I could do it. So, Barry, I'm delighted to award you the victory for this week. Very briefly before we go, it's time for the world's best news of the week. And we go to a senior care home in London where a gentleman called Robert Speaker, who is from Newcastle and was a member of my Jewish community, works. And Robert is also a talented amateur photographer and working in his role as the activities director at Sidmore Lodge Care in Edgware. He has reproduced many classic album covers using the, I was about to say inmates, that's not the word. Using the
residence.
Residence, thank God for that. Because obviously so many of them are bored to tears, not being able to see their family. And there's beautiful, there's ones of the Clash's London Calling, and there's one of Adele's 21, but the number's been replaced with 93.
Yeah,
that's Vera.
Great.
But my absolute favourite one is the one of Aladdin Zane. It is magnificent. I don't know the name of the woman who is in that picture, but she's there with the multicoloured Bowie lightning streak across her face, and she looks great.
It is amazing.
I cannot recommend you guys looking at that enough. It's really warm and uplifting. Before we go, Naomi, where can people find you and what can they find you doing when they get there?
You can probably find me on my website or on Twitter, actually, at Naomi Paxton, or on Instagram at Naomi.Paxton. And you can find Ada Camp, who's my comedy character, at Ada Camp on Twitter, A-D-A-C-A-M-P-E, and at Ada.Camp on Instagram. What am I doing at the moment? I'm doing lots of... We just had Museum Show Off. I'm doing online gigs as Ada and doing some bits and bobs. So yeah, there's always kind of stuff coming up. So just I'll put it on my Twitter feed.
Glorious. Well, we are all off to prepare a 60-hour sermon on the wonders of humanism. We're going to beat you, Zach Zendor. Yes, we are. Until next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. Thanks for having me.
Worst Foot Forward is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of Worst Foot Forward and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter via @podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.